Today we're going to be looking at Darwinism, which is Darwin's theory of evolution, massacred by a monarch. Now, the monarch that has massacred Darwin's theory is not an earthly human king like the infamous Henry VIII, who had six wives. Or was it the eight wives of Henry VI? Gotta know your history. No, it was six wives of Henry VIII. And he lived in the day of sovereign monarchs, where if you offended the king, he would simply say, off with his head, and it would be so. Although he is a bit more infamous for having said this on more than one occasion, off with her head. His wives who did not please him did not last very long. But again, the potentate, the monarch, the king that has massacred Darwin's theory, is not a human king like Henry VIII, but rather this king, the king of butterflies, the marvelous monarch. This creature is very light and delicate, and yet it contains mountain loads of heavy evidence that have crushed the credibility out of Darwin's theory. Now, how do the evolutionists deal with such an amazing creature as the monarch? How do they explain its origin? Well, basically, nowadays, they basically say, we are in the majority. The majority of scientists agree that creation is a bunch of hooey, and Darwin is right, and evolution is true. But you know, saying it doesn't make it so. Abraham Lincoln was once challenged by a heckler at one of his political stump tours. The heckler was trying to trap Abraham Lincoln in a trick question. He said, tell me this, Mr. Lincoln, if we call a sheep's tail a leg, how many legs does that sheep have? Wisely, Lincoln responded, well, sir, that sheep has four legs, because calling a tail a leg doesn't make it a leg. And if you get the majority on your side and the majority of so-called experts on your side to call it a leg, it still doesn't change reality. It still has only four legs. Nowadays, they really can't win a fair battle, academically, logically, with scientific evidence, with proven laws of chemistry and physics and mathematics. They lose, hands down. So they simply declare creation a non-competitor because they say so, and therefore evolution is the only show in town because they say so. And we see that here with this quote from one of the most obnoxious evolutionists in the world today, Richard Dawkins, author of the book The God Delusion. And he said, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Well, gee, if it appears to be designed, maybe it actually was. But he's excluded the possibility of a designer just by saying so, as if that makes it so. Here we have Sir Francis Crick, one of the Nobel laureates for discovering the double helical structure of DNA, the Watson and Crick team. He said, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. In other words, design will scream out at you as you study in science, but it's not allowed, you see. You have to always program and brainwash your mind with the idea that it had to have evolved. But as we shall see today with the monarch, we're looking at technology that cannot be duplicated, even in the 21st century. We could not, with all the dream team of the best scientists in the world and engineers and trillions of dollars available in the world's bank, we simply do not have the knowledge, the expertise, the technology to build a micro-aerial vehicle of the same size and weight as a monarch that can do what a monarch can do. With men, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. Now, I'm hitting the wrong thing, aren't I? Well, maybe that would help. Oops. Okay, well, what do we got? A mouse down here somewhere? We can do something. Oh, let's see if we've got this. I don't see it. Maybe we can get some help back there. No, that's okay. Oh, is it on here? Oh, wrong mouse. Oh, wonderful. Touch of the master's hand. That's what it does. Okay. All right. I'll touch the hem of your garment later. Okay. not blasphemy, just some humor. Okay. Anyway, Richard Dawkins again says, we have seen that living things are too improbable and too beautifully designed, quote unquote, to have come into existence by chance. So he's saying even the illusion of design, which happened by evolution and not by a designer, is still so complicated that it couldn't have happened by pure chance. Oh, well, then maybe we need a creator after all. Well, yes and no. He would be okay with a certain type of creator, not Jesus Christ, not Jesus, because Jesus said that you have to obey this horrible law. Love the Lord your God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, that's not a horrible law. We all know in our conscience that that's what we were created for, and that's what we're supposed to do. God is love. He wants to share his love with us and for us to love one another. But that simple law gets in the way of an awful lot of sin and selfishness. And rather than own up to the truth of that law, many men want to just get rid of God altogether. The only show in town to get rid of God is Darwin's theory of evolution. So he says, I'll be okay with a certain kind of designer. He calls him the blind watchmaker. Why? He's hearkening back to the old analogy of William Paley, who said if you're walking along a country trail and you stub your toe on something and you reach down, pick it up, and look at it, and it turns out to be a gold pocket watch. And he said nobody in their right mind would say, I know how this pocket watch got here. Some pine sap fell out of this here pine tree and chemically reacted with the soil, and centuries of solar energy provided the energy, and presto changeo, by natural forces, we get a beautiful gold pocket watch. He said nobody would believe such an idea because in all the history of science and observation, we have never seen that happen. We have seen complicated machines arise by the only adequate cause, which is an intelligent designer, an intelligent watchmaker. But nowadays, they're claiming that natural selection, which simply means survival of the fittest, somehow acts as a substitute designer and creator, which is a horrific fallacy of logic and of truth. Natural selection simply means survival of the fittest. For example, if you have a healthy lion who can hunt prey, and he has to compete with a crippled lion who's crippled, diseased, and half blind, well, it stands to reason that natural selection, selection of survival of the fittest, means the fit one will survive and the crippled one will die. Okay, who's going to dispute that? Creationists have always believed that. In fact, natural selection was first published on by Edward Blythe, a creationist, about a good quarter century before Darwin. But that doesn't answer the key question. The question is not, will a weak one die and a strong one survive? The question is, how did lions get there in the first place? You see? Now that question isn't even addressed. Yes, the fit will survive, the unfit will not survive, but how did we get lions, which are far more complex than any machine man has ever dreamed of creating? How did they get there? Doesn't really address that crucial question. So he uses the word blind, or the term blind watchmaker, for natural selection, a substitute creator. Now, it's okay, you know, blind people, because they still have intelligence and conscious awareness, they can do amazing things. I once heard a concert pianist do a beautiful piano concerto, totally blind, but because he had conscious awareness and intelligence, he had learned every key on that board by touch. He didn't have to look at it. And if I'd heard him on the radio, I never would have had any idea that he was blind, listening to the perfection of the music. But if you take away his consciousness and his intelligence, that's a little bit too much impairment. And natural selection is not just blind, it is also mindless and unconscious. You know, you can imagine laying in the emergency room, you've come in with terrible chest pains, and they run a diagnostic test on you, and they say, you've got a congenital heart problem. If we don't have immediate surgery within the hour, your heart's going to explode, you're going to die. Fortunately, we have a heart surgeon on staff, and here he comes, and the double doors of the emergency room burst open, and here comes the heart surgeon on a gurney. And you look over at him, and you notice that he is blind, mindless, and unconscious. This can mean only one thing. You are going to die, okay? That kind of surgeon can't help you with anything. Neither can the pathetic, blind, mindless, unconscious, so-called substitute creator of natural selection compete with the almighty creator, Jesus Christ, who has spoken through the prophets, who has spoken through his own mouth to us, who has fulfilled prophecy and risen from the dead. There are good reasons to believe not only there's a creator, because we can see it in the world of science and in nature, but because the creator has shown up and demonstrated his creator, his credentials for all who are really willing to listen to the truth. You know, there are those who deny truth if it bit them on the nose, and there are those who are, as Jesus said, of a good heart who will receive his word and receive the truth. Now then, here we have DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. This is not in and of itself life, but it is the information that controls the growth, self-maintenance, and eventual reproduction of living creatures. It is not life, but it is an important first step in getting life. Could we even get this? This molecule was not even known in Darwin's day when he proposed his theory in the middle of the 1800s. But we now know its structural complexity and its linguistic complexity. And we could calculate with proven laws of mathematics, logarithmic calculations, little algebra, it's not very complicated at all. In fact, in Bible college, I tell my students how to do the calculation, and they have to be able to show mastery of that on the exam. Now, we'll do that after this service, too. No, I'm just kidding. But anyway, conservatively, very conservatively, when we take in the structural specificity and the linguistic specificity, the odds of getting a less than average size DNA molecule of just 1,000 nucleotide units, the average is more like about 1,200, but even with that diminished size, the odds are in the realm of 1 in 10 to the power of 2,200. That's number one with 2,200 zeros after it. Now, is that a big number? Yes. How do we know? Well, it's bigger than the national debt under Obama, so you know it's got to be big. Okay. But it's so big that nobody can comprehend it, including myself, and I use big numbers all the time. So we'll use a standard to measure. One of the tiniest particles we know of, electrons that orbit around atoms, are so tiny they say that if you stacked one on top of another in a single line 1 inch high, it would take approximately 2.5 quadrillion electrons. Those buggers are awfully small. Yet if you counted them rapidly, 250 per minute, day and night, 24/7, it would only take you about 19 million years to count the electrons that stack up to 1 inch. But scientists have taken a stab at the approximate number of protons, electrons, and neutrons in the entire known observable universe with all those billions and billions of galaxies. Anybody have an estimate of what it is? Well, they've estimated it's about 10 to the power of 80. 10 multiplied by itself 80 times, or the number 1 with 80 zeros after it. Compare that to the number 1 with 2,200 zeros after it. That gives you a little inkling of how big this number is. What does it mean in practical terms? Very simple. If we had a trillion times a trillion times a trillion universes as big as ours, and we allowed a trillion times a trillion times a trillion years for tiny little atoms to come together randomly, try to form a DNA molecule, break apart, randomly reassemble, we allowed that to go on for a trillion, trillion, trillion years, and all those universes, you still would not put a dent, for all practical purposes, in that number, 10 to the power of 2,200. It could never happen in space and time, period. And when you look at the laws of thermodynamics and everything else, it would never happen because of physics as well as mathematics. So it is indeed a hopeless conundrum. Even if they got it, it would disintegrate by the second law long before you could ever hope to get another one. Yet they believe, with a faith that's beyond what I can muster. I have faith, but I'll put my faith in something far more reasonable than this type of tommy rot. Anyway, if you got that and you got a first cell, how'd you get that cell to evolve up into a monarch? Well, they claim mutation and natural selection. Now, mutation simply means change, but in the evolutionary sense, it means random, accidental, never intelligently guided change. Therefore, it is like a random error in information copying. Most mutations are produced by errors made during the replication of DNA. So, it's analogous, therefore, to a random typographical error. So we can do a little experiment, see how well their mechanism works. Recognize the sentence? Frequently used in typing practice because it contains all 26 letters of the English language. You can learn the basic keyboard by typing this sentence over and over and over again. The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dogs. Now, if what they say, random mistakes, random mutations to the genetic language, improve the information so better information can be selected, well, let's see how well that works. Let's have just three random typographical errors. We get the Dwick Brown Aox jumped over the Lasp Eogs. Well, that didn't happen very much. Maybe six random mistakes will do the trick. We get the Dwick Brazen Aox iumphed over the Lasp Eogs. Well, it sounds a little Swedish, perhaps, but I'll guarantee you, there's no Swede that can read that. It does not make sense in any language. It follows the rules of no language. Random mistakes destroy the delicate interdependent balance that makes information work. And you can't disrupt that balance without catastrophe. In other words, loss, degradation of information, not improvement and expansion of information. Now then, I love this analogy. We have this fellow sitting on his easy chair throwing rocks at his old analog television set. And he says, maybe this rock will mutate this analog set into a widescreen, high-definition TV. Oh, would that it were so. I have some old analog TVs. I'd love to throw rocks at them instead of spending thousands of dollars to get a new big widescreen high-definition TV. But we all know that damaging old parts does not make new and better parts of a superior technology. All it does is just keep damaging them until ultimately it's ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Everything goes downhill in accordance with the second law, and random accidents exacerbate that problem. Makes it worse, does not make it better. To his credit, Theodosius Dobzhansky, the greatest evolutionist of the 20th century, admitted that, at least on the surface, this appeared to be counterintuitive, or in other words, contrary to common sense. He said, an accident, a random change in any delicate mechanism can hardly be expected to improve it. Poking a stick into the machinery of one's watch or one's radio set will seldom make it work better. Indeed, the more you do that, the worse it will work until it does. The same is true of the biological genome. The more random accidents introduced into the delicate balance of information, the more you get death, disease, blindness. You get terrible catastrophic diseases and problems and death, but you don't get better information. So the natural selection deception can be stated thusly. Natural selection has no power to create new and better biological information. Rather, it is wholly at the mercy of random destructive mutations to provide necessary new information. Since random mutations cannot produce the needed results, natural selection is left helpless with nothing better to select. You see, it's not called the natural creator. They try to make it a creator. It doesn't create anything. It selects. And what it selects is something that's being degraded by accidental deprivation. So it simply cannot work. A child could understand this. You know, it's not rocket science. It's science for crying out loud. Now let's apply this to the marvelous monarch butterfly and see how well their random mutations and natural selection can explain its amazing characteristics. First of all, I ask the question, why is the monarch considered the king of the butterflies? I would submit there are at least 7 good reasons. Number 1, it lives longer than any other butterfly. Number 2, it has a wider distribution over the earth than any other butterfly. Number 3, it migrates further than any other butterfly, in excess of 5,000 kilometers, rivaling what some migrating birds actually do. Fourthly, it is the most widely recognized butterfly in North America and probably in the world because it is so famous. Fifthly, it can navigate over the ocean beyond the sight of land, which requires true navigation capability. And we're not talking just barely beyond the sight of land, we're talking going boldly over an ocean that's never seen before, where no monarch has gone before, boldly, and intersecting tiny islands it's never seen before, knowing somehow where they are, flying nearly 1,500 kilometers nonstop over an ocean it's never seen to intersect islands it's never seen. That doesn't happen by chance, I'll guarantee you. Now then, sixthly, it grows faster in proportion to its starting weight than any creature in the animal kingdom. And seventh, it is adorned with a crown and jewelry that mimics the metallic shine of genuine gold. This is somewhat rare in the world of biology, but I think it is fitting that the Creator has chosen to give the king of butterflies in its chrysalis stage a golden crown and golden jewelry. Now, metamorphosis is indeed an evolutionary enigma, a puzzle, a conundrum, something difficult for them to explain. It comes from the Greek word meta, meaning change, and morphe, meaning shape. And it is indeed a transformation not only of shape, but entire internal structure and function. It is miraculous. In fact, the evolutionists who don't believe in a miracle worker constantly refer to this process as, quote unquote, miraculous. That's how astonishing it really is. And it's something that their theory cannot explain, can't begin to make any sense. Why would this creature, in essence, commit suicide, put itself in a sarcophagus or coffin of its own making, use chemical machines called enzymes to almost break down all of its internal structure and almost all of its internal cells, do a kind of a green fluid of basic biochemicals, the building blocks, and then with as little as 8 days, put everything back together entirely differently and resurrect essentially from the dead? What survival value is there in committing suicide and just hoping some blind random destructive mutations will, you know, show up and give you the information to get out of that mess? Obviously, it had to be thought out. Every step, every stage had to be thought out and put into the blueprint with information to perfection, because this is the ultimate interdependent system or irreducibly complex system. In other words, it either all works together or it doesn't work at all. If one little step misfires, if one little step is missing, the whole process is failure. And failure in this sense means death and extinction. Yet the monarchs have been doing this for thousands of years. So let's see how the process works. First of all, we have the eggs laid by the female on the only food that the caterpillars can eat, monarch caterpillars, is milkweed. Now, we've had a big die-off of monarchs in recent years, about 90%. Used to be upwards of 300 million migrating across the North American continent. Now it's only about 30 million. Part of the problem is pesticides. Part of the problem is people kill milkweed because it's considered a noxious weed, but it's the only thing that they can eat. You want to attract monarchs? Plant milkweed in your flower garden, then you'll probably get some. Anyway, these eggs are laid on that only source of food, and the female can lay up to 400 during her brief lifespan of about 4 weeks. Now, these eggs are beautiful, almost look like a kind of a domed cathedral, and they're only about 4/100ths of an inch in diameter, very tiny. Out of that comes a tiny little worm, tiny little monarch caterpillar, which then turns around and eats the remnants of its eggshell to get certain nutrition. It's only about 2 millimeters long when it comes out. And this thing eats and grows and eats and grows to within about 10 to 20 days, it has grown to about 3,000 times heavier than this little worm that comes out of the egg. They're truly baby boomers in that respect, okay? Now then, the caterpillar is amazingly programmed in its DNA with some wisdom without which it would die. You see, it uses the milkweed toxin to make itself undesirable to predators. Any bird or other predator that tries to eat one of these caterpillars, or even the adult stage butterfly, that milkweed toxin tastes terrible, would make them sick, and probably kill them if they ate too much of it. So that's why we have the black stripes highlighted by bright colors. In this case, in the caterpillar, black outline with yellow and white. That's advertising, like neon signs, don't eat me, I'm poisonous, I taste terrible, leave me alone. Now in other cases, like the walking stick, it tries to mimic a stick, you know, you can't see it, it camouflages. But this is advertising, leave me alone, because you won't like me. Now notice the caterpillars start eating at the center of the milkweed leaf, which doesn't seem to make sense, because much easier to get a hold of it at the edges. But the milkweed plant deploys most of its toxin at the edge of the leaves, and not that much at the center, because that's where most critters try to get a hold of it, is at the edge. But the caterpillar builds up immunity. It doesn't automatically have complete immunity to milkweed toxin, and so it has to build it up gradually. And if it overdoses, it would die. That's the end of it, extinction, no more monarchs. But somebody programmed the wisdom in its behavior to go to the center where it's difficult, it has to scuff and scuff and finally get a hole where it can get its mandible in there and start eating. Now the leaf detects the damage, and so it starts redeploying its toxin from the edges of the leaves down toward the center. But by then, the wisdom programmed into the monarch caterpillar is that it goes out and starts eating at the edges. Thus, it gradually builds up immunity to the milkweed toxin, something that will benefit it for its whole life, even in its monarch stage, and it does so without killing itself. I don't think that wisdom came from a bunch of blind, random, destructive mutations. Now then, it eats and grows and molts and eats and grows and molts until, in as little as 10 to 20 days, it has grown 3,000 times heavier than it started. To put this in human terms, if we had a 6-pound baby born, in no more than 20 days, it would weigh 18,000 pounds. That's a baby boomer for sure. And it's the fastest growth rate seen in the world of biology. So it detects that it has sufficient chemistry, has enough nutrition, enough energy stored, so that it can now go into its amazing chrysalis stage. Now the first thing it does is that it has glands that produce something that we can't duplicate today, silk. We can't quite match like spider silk and silk like this, you know, we can't quite get the recipe. It's very, very complex. And we wish we could, because it would be very useful to us. But here again, what is impossible for man is not impossible for God. This creature has to have those silk glands, they have to work, they have to do something we haven't been able to achieve. So it takes biological superglue and plants that silk on the stem of the milkweed, then it clasps onto it with little claspers at the end of its body, and it hangs in a J shape. I think that's interesting. Hangs in the J for Jesus, its creator. Well, I'll put it that way, why not? It's true. Okay, so it hangs like that. When that happens, within about 12 hours, it's ready to go through this amazing metamorphic process. So you want to be ready the following day with your video camera or iPhone or whatever you want to use to watch this amazing process, which has been documented to happen in as little as 60 seconds, although it usually takes several minutes. So it hangs like that, then begins to stretch out, and it begins to gyrate, and the skin has to split at just the right place behind its head here, okay? And it splits and moves forward, and on the inside, it's mind-boggling what is going on. We have all kinds of chemical machines, molecular machines, that are breaking down certain substances, simultaneously taking those raw building products and building up something else. It's incredibly complex. I couldn't begin to do it justice with mere words. But this happens in a matter of minutes. Now, again, all this stuff has to be done right. What if the enzymes break down some of the imaginal cells that contain the DNA for the final transformation into a butterfly? How does it know by blind random destructive mutations what cells to break down and what cells not to? All that has to be thought out and programmed, or it is absolute failure and extinction. But it works miraculously, even as the evolutionists use that term to describe it. Now, when it gets to this stage here, we're kind of in a bit of a trouble, because the claspers are attached to the outer skin. And when the skin sloughs off, the claspers go with it. If this falls to the ground at this stage, it will deform and cannot correctly form a butterfly, which means death and extinction. because it has to fly south because it will die in the winter. They cannot tolerate cold weather. So they got to go to the lower latitudes, most of them down to Mexico and Guatemala, and on the western side of the Rocky Mountains down to Southern California and the Baja Peninsula. Anyway, you have to have this little post, pre-thought out, pre-constructed. It's called a cremaster, this little black post here, okay? That has to be prepared, and remember, it's lost its eyes, retreated into darkness, breaking down almost all of its body components and cells, yet it has to retain muscles in this post to stick up blindly and hit that little target. If it came out to the side and missed, it would fall to the ground. Extinction. Just some little thing like that wasn't perfect. They'd all be extinct thousands of years ago. But it seems to work amazingly well. It has little hooks on the end of that cremaster like Velcro. So it hits that little patch of silk, hangs onto it, works brilliantly. Finally, it has to adopt this shape. If it is deformed or misshapen, it will not work. The butterfly will be deformed and cannot fly and cannot migrate. So all of this has to happen perfectly, first time, every time, or extinction as a result. It had to be thought out ahead of time. It can't be programmed by blind, random, destructive mutations who have no foresight. They can't think. They can't realize an engineering solution. It can't have forethought to think, well, they're going to have this problem, this problem. It has to be taken care of. No, only a master engineer can do that. And there had to have been a master engineer to do this. Now then, it retreats into this coffin or sarcophagus of its own making, loses its eyes, retreats into darkness, breaks itself down. For what? Hoping blind, random, destructive mutations will give it the power to resurrect? I don't think so. I think God did this on purpose to make it so hard for the evolutionists to justify believing that evolution could explain something like this. It reminds me of what John F. Kennedy said when he was talking about putting the man on the moon in the 1960s. He said, "We choose to do these things because they are hard, not because they are easy." And I think God made this so hard for evolutionists to explain so they would be without excuse. There's simply no reason that a butterfly would take the risk, you know, based on survival of the fittest. There's something not much more fit for survival than putting yourself in a coffin and decomposing yourself as if you're rotting in the grave. But that's what this does. And by some amazing power, it does essentially resurrect from the dead. And only God can do that. Now then, we find that in as little as 8 days, eight, the number of new beginnings, all those basic biochemical building blocks are utilized by chemical machines, and a new blueprint in the imaginal cells kicks in and turns it into an entirely different type of creature with different type of locomotion, different type of sensors, different type of legs, different type of digestive system, different in every imaginable way. And it starts to come out of that chrysalis after about the eighth day, which has to be creased in the back so it can push with its legs and break it open. If even that little crease were missing, it would be trapped and die in its own coffin. Even that had to be thought out ahead of time and put there at the right place at the right time. So it does break out, has tremendous instinct to hang on to the remnants of that chrysalis, because if it falls to the ground while it's still wet and its wings are still crumpled, they will not deploy properly, it cannot fly. And if it doesn't fly, it dies. It has to migrate to continue the life cycle. So within usually about 20 to 30 minutes, its wings are dry, fully deployed, it's able to take off, in some cases, going over oceans and intersecting tiny islands it's never seen before, on an epic journey of over 5,000 kilometers. I don't think that happens by chance either. So the metamorphic process is indeed an enigma for evolutionists, but I believe it was put there by God, put there to show that this is impossible for evolution to do. A master engineer had to think this out and program it and make it work every time. And it is a beautiful type and shadow in nature of death and resurrection, reminding us that what God can do for the monarch butterfly, he can do for us. Though we die, though we decompose in the grave, there is a great almighty God who can resurrect us from the dead. His name is Jesus Christ, and he said, "I am the resurrection and the life." Now we're going to look at monarch migration, a navigational nightmare for evolution. How in the world blind, random, destructive mutations could endow this creature with this amazing capability that surpasses GPS, which we've only had in very modern times? It's mind-boggling when you look at it. Now, I quote here Jules H. Poirier, an aerospace navigational engineer and a creationist scientist in engineering science, and he worked for NASA in aerospace navigation for both space flight and for aircraft flight. And he knew how hard it was to make a navigational system actually work, But he knew it was exponentially more difficult when you make it smaller and smaller. So he was really enamored and amazed at the monarch. I mean, this thing has a brain the size of a pinhead. Yet it has all these marvelous navigational capabilities. So he studied it quite a bit and actually wrote a book on it, which I would highly recommend, From Darkness to Light to Flight, Monarch, the Miracle Butterfly. In this book, he intimates how he was once asked to give a lecture to his fellow engineers. His engineering company wanted the engineers to develop good public speaking ability in case the news media stopped in unannounced and wanted to interview them. They would do it with confidence. So he had to prepare a speech that he would give to his fellow engineers, you know, maybe 15, 20 minutes. So he used his knowledge of the monarch butterfly, and in his speech he challenged them to design and build and make work a micro-navigating, self-navigating aerial vehicle that could match the capabilities of the monarch. Now, he didn't tell them that he was trying to get them to match the monarch's capabilities. He just said, I want you to be challenged and to do the building of this micro-aerial vehicle. So his challenge to his fellow engineers was thusly, design and build the following optical lens and electrical navigation system. Requirements for the lens system. The lens system must be able to see in all directions simultaneously, like the compound eyes of the monarch. The lens system must be capable of seeing all the colors of the rainbow and also ultraviolet light and detect the polarization of sunlight. The lens system must detect objects as small as 4/100ths of an inch in diameter to as large as 10 feet from distances of 1 inch to 20 feet, as we know the monarch is capable of doing. Requirements for the lens system continued. The light from the lens system must be converted into electrical voltage pulses, whose magnitudes shall be proportional to the light intensity, a maximum amplitude or voltage of only 20 millivolts, delivered to a central computer, which, by the way, cannot be any larger than the head of a pin, via an electrical network system containing no more than 72,000 paths. The electrical pulses must have a discernible value even when the light intensity is only that of a full moon. The central computer must be capable of translating as many as 72,000 electrical voltage pulses into a meaningful image. Requirements for the navigation system. As you'll see, the requirements keep getting harder and harder. Sensors must be provided to detect the direction of the Earth's magnetic field and the position of the sun. The central computer must be able, from an input of information on the sun's position and the Earth's magnetic field, to determine its present position to an accuracy of plus or minus 100 feet, or basically to duplicate a GPS level of accuracy. The computer must be capable of directing its navigation pilot, which is a mechanical autopilot, to a new location that it's never seen before, as far away as 3,000 miles, the equivalent of 5,000 kilometers, to an accuracy of plus or minus 100 feet. It must also be able to navigate over the ocean beyond the sight of land. Other requirements. Now it starts getting really hard, okay? The system must be designed to weigh less than 0.5 grams. Now, we can make self-navigating aerial vehicles that can do these things, but we cannot make them this small. That God can do, but man cannot. The system must be smaller in its entirety than a pea for size and weight. The system must be designed to be built in 8 days by one person in total darkness using mostly basic raw materials and very few prefabricated parts. That's what the monarch does in that chrysalis stage. And the system must have the capability to continually reproduce itself several times per year for at least several thousand years while maintaining sufficient quality control so its navigation equipment can still accomplish the precision mission requirements. Now, we cannot make any machine, no matter how big or small, capable of autonomous self-replication. In other words, taking energy and raw materials from the environment, it can repeatedly make a virtual exact copy of itself over and over again. Every living creature is capable of that. It is unknown in the world of human technology. This only God can do. It's the finger of God. And we see it in every living creature. But man in the 21st century cannot do that. So, and much less make it last, man make any mechanical device that would run continuously, self-diagnosing, self-repairing, and self-reproducing for thousands of years? It's inconceivable. But with God, all things are possible. Now, looking at the monarch migration, they go northward from Mexico primarily, chasing the blooming of their only food, milkweed, and they get up as high as the U.S.-Canada border. About the highest they get is up here, which is in this bay there, right near the border of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. Those are the ones that travel in excess of 5,000 kilometers, getting down to Mexico and Guatemala. Now, they start out, again, this new generation, going on a flight, no new butterflies, have never seen this territory before. Yeah, they chase the milkweed up. The ones that go the furthest go up there. However, their normal life cycle is only about 4 weeks. They lay eggs, they die, you know, new generation takes over. Usually it's the third or fourth generation that makes it up this high. But now they have to go all the way back, and they have to overwinter for a number of months and still have enough lifespan left to fly up and start the new generation again. So what kicks in here is a timing mechanism, somehow by blind random destructive mutations. And this generation is called the Methuselah generation, after Methuselah in the Bible, the oldest living man recorded. And they don't live for about 4 weeks. They live a minimum of 8 months and have been documented to live up to a year, longer than any other butterfly, giving them ample lifespan to fly all the way back, some 5,000 plus kilometers, spend several months overwintering, waiting for the milkweed to start blooming again so they can then have enough lifespan to fly up and lay eggs and start the life cycle again. If that Methuselah timing mechanism weren't there, recognized in the right generation, they'd all go extinct. Again, somebody thought this out. It did not happen by chance. Now, coming back down west of the Rocky Mountains, they usually go down to Southern California and the Baja Peninsula. Those east of the Rocky Mountains generally go down to Mexico. Most of them go to overwintering sites about 200 miles west of Mexico City in the Neovolcanic Mountains, where they can come in by the millions. It's just a spectacular sight if you ever get the opportunity to be down there at the right time. And there are those that come all the way from New Brunswick, Nova Scotia. Interestingly, they'll fly across the Gulf of Mexico. Now, they've never made this flight before. How do they know when they get over the Gulf of Mexico outside the sight of land that there's any other land to get? Maybe it's, you know, there is no Mexico. Maybe there's nothing but the Pacific Ocean, and they'll run out of fuel and die. But they don't have to worry. Somebody gave them a GPS system and a map of the Earth that they can follow. And I don't think that got there by chance either. Now, at the Neovolcanic Mountains, where we get them coming in by the millions, it is a spectacular pageantry of color and motion. If you've ever seen it on film even, it is quite breathtaking. And they come in by the millions, they gather together on these trees, and they'll cluster together because it is rather high altitude, so it can get cold at night. And they cluster together to conserve their body temperature, and they just keep coming in and coming in, clustering and clustering by the millions, to the point that some of these large trees literally are estimated to contain 100,000 monarchs per tree. It's one of the most spectacular sights to be seen in the world of biology. Also, by tagging each generation, watching, you know, which one laid eggs and how those eggs developed, keeping track of the caterpillars, a lot of man hours involved in that, but painstakingly, they have tagged and tracked these generations. And they have proved that many of these Methuselah generation come back and not only get within 100 feet of the tree that was, you know, that their great-grandparents left from, they actually go to the very same tree, showing they have even more precise navigation than GPS. Okay, here we have a satellite map of North America. Can anybody identify on this map the position of the Bahama Islands? We see they're very small, and from space you can't hardly even see them. Now, with a close-up, can you see them? Well, they're right at the base of this red arrow right there, very tiny. And yet these monarchs take off from up there in New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, fly over 1,350 kilometers over an ocean it's never seen, intersect these tiny islands they've never seen before. That does not happen by chance. That takes precision navigation capability, as we shall see. So they start out there, they go to the Bahamas. Then, if they kept going that way, they'd run out of fuel and they'd end up in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. But they know that they have to turn back. They have to angle back to intersect these islands down here, the Bahamas. They fuel up on nectar, then they fly from there to Cuba. Now, the monarchs are created by God, so they are conservative, and they don't like to stay in communist Cuba very long. So they fill up on nectar, and they go somewhere a lot nicer, Jamaica. One final fill up nectar fuel, and they fly across the ocean, in this case, to their overwintering grounds at the base of the Yucatan Peninsula in the country of Guatemala. Here again, the zigzag pattern shows they actually know, before they take off, the position of these islands and can intersect them with precision. That did not happen by chance. There's just no way, Jose, that can be explained. So what are the secrets of the monarch's navigation capabilities? Well, with their compound eyes, they're able to detect the polarization of sunlight, which means that they're able to detect where the sun is, even if it's hiding behind a mostly cloudy sky. You just need a little window of blue, and using the polarization of sunlight, they can detect the position of the sun, which is necessary because they use the sun to navigate by. But because of the rotation of the Earth, the sun appears to be constantly moving across the sky. So their supercomputer has to have an automatic compensator to help them use that too. Didn't happen by chance. So they determine, for example, the sun is there. Well, they also have to have the equivalent of a sextant to accurately measure the position of the sun above the horizon, which they have these little slits in their antenna that work very well for that. They also have to have a built-in calendar, because when you take astronomical observations, you have to know what season of the year it is, because the sun will only rise at a certain azimuth and only go to a certain zenith or highest position at different places and different seasons of the year. You also have to have the equivalent of a navigator's almanac, where you can take this astronomical data, run it through the pre-digested mathematics, and get the right answer. All that's compacted into a little computer, no bigger than the head of a pin. Now, that's fine for determining latitude. You have to also determine longitude. Now, the easiest way to do that is to have accurate clocks. A clock that gives you your precise local time, where you are, and you compare that with a clock at zero longitude, or also known as Zulu time in the military, or Greenwich Mean Time, because back when England was a maritime power, they decided zero longitude would run right through the Naval Observatory city of Greenwich, England. And so there we have the prime meridian, zero longitude. So you have a clock that tells you your time where you are, and a clock that tells you the time at the prime meridian. You then take that data, subtract, to find the difference in minutes between these two clocks. Then you take that number and divide by a certain number to determine accurately your longitude. Does anybody know what number you divide by? Well, I'm sorry, you're all going to be lost at sea. Too bad, so sad. If you're monarch, you don't have to worry about it. Your pinhead-sized supercomputer takes care of all of that automatically. But even all that's not good enough. What if it's totally cloudy and totally foggy? Well, it has a backup navigation system, and that is in the form of a magnetic compass. It can actually get directional information off the Earth's magnetic field. And then when it clears up, it gets more precise astronomical measurements for navigation. But even all this is worthless unless you have something else. Anybody know what it is? You have to have an accurate, emphasis on accurate, map of the Earth. For example, you're taking off from a place you've never been before over here, say near New Brunswick in Nova Scotia. You have to fly about 1,350 kilometers to find the Bermuda Islands you've never seen before. What if your map shows the position of the Bermuda Islands, but you do all the navigational calculation, you go to the right longitude and latitude, and lo and behold, the islands aren't there? What's the problem? Not your calculations. The problem is you're using an inaccurate map. It's showing the islands where they are, but they really aren't there. It's inaccurate. Talk about irreducible complexity. All this stuff has to work together precisely, and for thousands of years, without error, or you go extinct. Pretty high stakes. I don't think evolution could begin to explain this. So, to put it in perspective, you can ask the question, how well could you navigate under such circumstances? Well, if you were put in a box like a coffin and dropped off at the border of that bay there by New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, and you realize, well, I've got to navigate over an ocean I've never seen, try to find these islands I've never seen, but called the Bahamas, you might take comfort that in the Boy Scouts, they taught me the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. And at night, off the rim of the Big Dipper, I can find Polaris, the North Star, to determine true north. But what if it's cloudy or foggy? Well, last time you ate a box of Cracker Jacks, you had the presence of mind to keep the toy, and it turned out to be, praise God, a magnetic compass. Okay? So now you're feeling pretty confident. By golly, I know north, south, east, and west. I can now take off over this ocean I've never seen to find these islands I've never seen. But it dawns on you, say you can fly, it dawns on you that that's not enough. You have to know the precise longitude and latitude on the map. You got to have a map that has accurate, shows the longitude and latitude. You have to know the longitude and latitude where you are, because your angle of trajectory to try to intercept the target will be a different angle depending on where those islands are located. You have to know where you are and where it is, and you have to know that before you take off or you're going to commit suicide. Monarchs know that. and have known it somehow for thousands of years. So I quote here the engineer Jules Parrier. He said it would be extremely difficult for humans to duplicate the navigational achievements of monarch butterflies. Human navigators would require a clock, a sextant, a current astronomical almanac, a compass, and a current magnetic map of the region. Even with these instruments, they would require a high level of observational skill and computational ability to travel some 3,600 kilometers across a continent between specific locations. Even more so when they're flying in excess of 5,000 kilometers over an ocean they've never seen and hitting tiny islands they have never seen before. So recognizing design and conclusion, is there a double standard? I would say so. On the left, we have the Harvard Microbotic Fly. It took millions of tax dollars to make this thing hover without crashing. Oh, they were so proud of that. They could even make it veer left or right on command. Wow. But if you look at it closely, you'll notice tiny little copper wires. That indicates it has an off-board power source. If they were to put a battery on it, it would probably have a very limited flight endurance, and it might not even be able to take off with the extra weight of the battery. So although its size and weight limitations can pretty much match the Monarch, it sure can't match the navigational capability, because you can't put a GPS computer on something this small, and it cannot match flight endurance. Monarchs are known to fly day and night, you know, all weather conditions. They can go over oceans, they can travel up to at least nearly 1,500 kilometers nonstop. This thing couldn't even begin to compete. We'll have to get a little bit bigger. Well, here we have a hand-launched aerial vehicle with a camera in it used to spy on the enemy by the military. It's called the Raven. It's big enough to have a GPS computer. It's programmed with a laptop military computer. And it has a very limited flight endurance, much bigger and heavier than the Monarch, but only has about a 12-mile flight endurance. So you launch the thing, it goes out about 6 miles, looks over the hill with the camera, sees what the enemy is doing. That's come right back quick, or it'll run out of power and crash. The Monarch can go where it's never gone before without anybody programming it. It's already in its DNA, and go up to 1,500 kilometers. So this thing can't begin to compete. To compete, we have to get much bigger. Something like this, the Tomahawk cruise missile. This thing weighs about 2,900 pounds. Costs anywhere between the basic model, about $1.5 billion, to the more complex models, $3 million taxpayer money per missile. And, you know, it can go usually about 1,000, maybe 1,200 miles at the most, most of them about 1,000 nowadays, and hit within 30 feet of the intended target, which, which is good enough, you know, to take out terrorists or whatever. But we can ask some very cogent questions. For example, which is more complex, the Tomahawk cruise missile or the Monarch butterfly? Here again, anyone who knows anything in the world of biology knows that the tiniest prokaryotic bacterium is more complex than any machine man's ever dared dream of creating, much less succeeded. That tiny bacterium can do self-maintenance, repair, and autonomous self-replication, something this cruise missile or any other machine of human invention cannot do. Only God seemingly can make such amazing creations. So it's not nearly as complex. Is it more reliable? Well, I don't think so. Not only can the Monarch fly and locate its own fuel to refuel, the Tomahawk can't even refuel itself. It's one way. And it certainly can't reproduce itself and keep generations going for thousands of years. The Monarch has a different navigation system. It uses astronomical and magnetic field calculations in its supercomputer, making it invulnerable to something our weapons are very vulnerable to. Anti-satellite missiles knocking down our GPS satellites. Even, you know, a big electromagnetic pulse, you explode a thermonuclear weapon over the continent, not only wipes out all our GPS satellites, wipe out most of our electronics on the continent, something a lot of people are worried about nowadays with the terrorists. Or even there's just a big solar storm, a big solar flare, a big massive coronal ejection from the sun, it would fry our satellites and a lot of our electronics. What would it do to the Monarch? Nothing. It would still navigate with precision as it has for thousands of years. It's far more reliable, far more complex. Our greatest fighters today, the F-15 Eagle and F-22 Raptor, for every hour of flight, they have to be on the ground minimum 12 hours for inspection, maintenance, and repair. For every hour of flight, the Monarch has been going self-repairing, self-maintaining, self-reproducing for thousands of years. There's no comparison between what our engineers can do and what the Almighty Engineer, Jesus Christ, can do, that we see his handiwork all around us. Lastly, we can ask which was designed and which happened by chance. Sadly, they'll point to the cruise missile and say, oh, we're so proud of our technology in the 21st century. We can take out terrorists 1,000 miles away with the push of a button. Really? Well, nobody in their right mind would say the missile happened by chance, but something far more complex, far more capable, far more reliable, far more amazing in every respect. They say, oh, a bunch of blind random accidents, put that together. That's why the Bible says they are turned over to a reprobate mind. They're without excuse. When they knew God but would not honor him as God, God said, okay, my judgment is to let you go your way and believe your lies and reap the consequences of that, unfortunately. Darwin's confession in his famous book, The Origin of Species, he said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Compare that to the amazing capabilities of the monarch butterfly. He also said concerning instincts, remember all their navigation is instinctual, programmed into it. He said many instincts are so wonderful that their development will probably appear to the reader a difficulty sufficient to overthrow my whole theory. Well, when we look at the miracle of metamorphic transformation, how interdependent, how irreducibly complex it is, and all the navigational systems that have to be there used properly every year, it is irreducibly complex and cannot be explained by Darwin's theory. Finally, I ask very cogent questions. Why did God create the monarch butterfly? What was his motivation? Well, I suggest there are at least two. One, to teach us of God's attributes. As it says in the book of Job, but now ask the beasts, and they will teach you, and the birds of the air, and they will tell you, and the fish of the sea will explain to you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In essence, what Job is saying here is if animals were given a voice to speak, like Balaam's donkey, they wouldn't say, oh, praise Darwin, thank goodness for evolution. They'd say, we were made by the hand of the Lord. Praise God. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. And the most fearfully and wonderfully made creature of all is the creature made in God's image, man himself. Romans chapter 1, verse 20, again, points out, man is without excuse. The evidence is irrefutable. For ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature and attributes, that is, his eternal power and divinity, have been made intelligible and clearly discernible in and through the things that have been made. His handiworks. Today we've looked at just one of his marvelous handiworks, the amazing monarch butterfly. So men are without excuse, altogether without any defense or justification, when they reject God as creator and believe the incredible lie of Darwinian evolution. Secondly, we can ask, why did God create the monarch butterfly? To give us a beautiful illustration of his power to cause miraculous transformation from spiritual death and physical death to life everlasting. As it says in 2 Corinthians 5:17, therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. Even as that lowly, poisonous worm, it transforms miraculously and seemingly from death through resurrection into a glorious heavenly creature. God can do that with us, and he paid quite a price to do it. He had to give the king's ransom through the blood of his son, who is our creator. So as it says again, a penetrating question in Job chapter 25, how then can man be righteous before God? Or how can he be pure who is born of a woman? If even the moon does not shine and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man, who is a maggot, and a son of man, who is a worm? Well, man is said to be made in the image of God. He's only briefly a little bit lower than the angels, but in our redeemed state, Paul says what? We will judge the angels. We will sit in the throne with Christ the Creator as his bride, his queen, co-regent of heaven. But why are we considered to be lowly maggots that eat rotting flesh and stink? Well, it's because of the fall, our alienation from God, and our sinful nature. As it says in Jeremiah, the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. We are helpless and hopeless without God intervening. Big difference in Christianity. Every other religion, you have to do it yourself. Christianity, God reaches down sovereignly to helpless people and miraculously gives them eternal life and salvation. God gets all the glory because he does it all. All we do is choose to receive it. So, Christ had to partake of our humanity as our kinsman redeemer. He became lower than the angels. He humbled himself to become in the form of a man and give up his divine attributes, as it says in Philippians. He emptied himself, took on the form of man, and died a death, even the death of the cross. You know, in Psalm 22, 1,000 years before the death of Christ, in the spirit of prophecy, we have King David speaking, and he spoke of many of the things experienced by Christ on the cross as if he were there. And the very first words of that psalm were words spoken by Christ himself while on the cross. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Goes on to say, my enemies have compassed me about. They have pierced my hands and my feet. All my bones are out of joint. My tongue cleaves to my jaw. The intense thirst from crucifixion and blood loss. But then it says something a lot of people miss. Jesus on the cross, being seen by King David in the spirit of prophecy, he said, but I am a worm and not a man. He is so magnificent, beyond space and time, creator of the universe. And yet, although he's without parallel, he would humble himself so much to become not just lower than the angels, not just a man, not just die the humiliating death of the cross, but to become that vile worm, that maggot, who would ingest our sin and die because of it. You know, the Bible says this, and I don't understand how God did it. But it says, he who knew no sin was made to be sin, that we might be the righteousness of God in him. He became sin. He became that maggot. He partook of the filth and the ugliness and the stench of humanity. He humbled himself lower than the low. Why? Because you're that valuable. You're that much of a treasure to him. You're made in his image, destined to be his children, his bride. And there's no price he would not pay to win you back. Not even becoming a worm full of sin. As it says in Philippians chapter 3, Christ shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body, according to the working whereby he is able even to subdue all things unto himself. There's nothing he can't do. There's nothing he wouldn't do for you. You're that valuable. Don't ever let the world and the devil tell you you're not important. Evolution tells you that lie. Such a terrible lie. You are the most valuable treasure in the universe. The Creator paid everything for you. And he will do with you what he has done with the monarch. Every spring and summer, we get this beautiful type and shadow and nature of the power of God. Take a lowly, poisonous, crawling worm, and through seeming death and decomposition, raise it from the dead into a glorious heavenly creature. God promises he can do that. We see it in the monarch. But what God can do for the monarch, he can do for us. But when he does it for us, it's far more significant. And the blessing of it is literally everlasting. That's a good message of the gospel of Jesus Christ, seen in the life cycle of the monarch butterfly, reminding us of his power, reminding us of his truth, reminding us of what Jesus did for us. So I thank you for today. Hope this has been helpful to you. Hope you'll take advantage of the DVDs I have available back there, including the one that I did today. So God bless you. I hope we see you out here tonight. Tonight we're going to be looking at Stephen Hawking's evolutionism, the religion that offers nothing. This man has been so idolized and lionized that many people think whatever he says has to be true because he's so much smarter than us. But we'll see he has said crazy things that no one should believe, and that we don't have to be intimidated, that logic and truth is on our side. We don't have to believe his evolutionary religion. We have the truth faith that makes sense scientifically and logically, and we can hold our heads high and know that we have the truth. So I hope we'll see you tonight. Pastor, thank you very much.